Hello and welcome to Lee Strickland's Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's program, we are talking with Ty Hagler, principal at Trigg. And Ty has a unique background. He was an Olympic athlete, sprint kayaking, which I know nothing about. Maybe we can get Ty to tell us about that. And he transitioned from that background into being an innovative product designer for Home Depot in their innovation department. That's a big transition. I want to know how he did that. And his connection with Home Depot became as being a sponsored athlete in those Olympic trials and events. And he has now made that transition into owning his own company, which he founded in 2006. He's got an MBA from NC State that he did whilst running that company. He's just got a great pragmatic approach to building a small business, to giving outstanding service, to product design, marketing, and I just can't say enough great things about Ty. We've worked with each other on some client projects. And his company is as innovative in design and marketing consulting as his personality and his background is. And so I want Ty to share with us today about product design management, about commercialization, how he builds brands for a long term, what is brand identity, all the different things that he does. And I think you're going to really find those insights and his experiences and his life story really great and innovative. And we're just going to jump into it today. So, Ty, thanks for being on the show.
Wow, great. Thanks, Lee. I really appreciate the introduction there.
Well, you have been one of the best product designers and one of the most innovative people I've worked with on client projects in that field. So let's explain to the listeners just what product design is and give us that framework.
Okay, sure. Absolutely. So at product design, we come at it from the discipline of industrial design. That's my undergraduate degree from Georgia Tech is in industrial design. And that the approach is coming at a thing, starting with the voice of the customer, understanding what, you know, really driving down to what really is the problem. And then you do that through observational research, going out and shadowing people. And then as you understand what that opportunity is, then you can start to develop ideas. And we take an approach to idea generation, concept development, where we really try to generate multiple concepts. We don't get stuck on the
first one.
So
you're just not saying, oh, I got a great idea, let's go do that one.
Right, exactly. Okay. You try to generate multiple because at the end of the day, you're not really sure what it is that's going to best fit somebody else's needs. And so one of the expressions we use, and this really comes from the shoe design industry, which is one of the big areas for product development, is that you don't get married to your shoe.
Okay.
In the, you know, you, it's easy for a designer to get really, really attached to one idea. But at the end of the day, it's not about the designer. It's about what best serves the customer. And so that's why we try to really have that separation, have multiple ideas, and then churn them through the voice of the customer and really try to arrive at a best fit solution for everybody.
So let's talk about this. You were at Home Depot.
Correct.
You actually convinced them, I think, from your background, to start kind of an innovation product development type initiative. Want to hear about that, but how does that come into play when you're working internally with Home Depot or with your clients here? How do you know even where you want to start looking at which problem?
That's a great question. That really gets into an opportunity identification.
Okay.
Part of that is strategic, is, you know, what business are we in? And as you drill down, there's really kind of four different methodologies for that fuzzy front end.
Love that term, fuzzy front end, meaning nothing's precise, nothing's in focus yet, and you're trying to get that focus.
Exactly. So in some cases, you just know that, hey, there's a product category we want to play in. And so, it may be, you know, outdoor living or outdoor furniture. And so you'd start with doing competitive landscaping, trend forecasting.
Which is not doing yard work, you mean looking out at the marketplace, what's there,
exactly.
Who's doing what, what's getting bought, what are the trends?
Right.
How do you take interior stuff to the exterior trends, those kind of things?
Exactly.
Okay.
And you map that along, you know, maybe a price and then also another like major driver for that given category. And you look for where those opportunities are, those holes in the map, where you might be able to do new product positioning. And so...
So, like, that's white space.
Exactly.
So there's lots of product around, and everybody talks about the white space. So when you look at that, you're looking to see where the need is, where there's nothing answering that, and you can do it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that really is, you know, ultimately it's about trying to differentiate yourself from your competitors. So we in particular use a methodology. It's gotten a lot of popularity lately called design thinking.
Okay.
Where you're really taking, similar to the concept approach we just described,
right,
where you're basically, you know, going after intuitive insight of looking at what are customers really trying to do, and you know, what are the unspoken needs. There's a big difference between what people say and what they do.
Right.
Using those insights to then go through and iterate either prototype solutions or concept sketches until you get to a point where you've arrived at a solution that's going to resonate with customers.
So when I think of that type of differentiation, it's like building the old mainframes and then the old PCs, and you went to an iPad, and there was more intuitive feel to that. So one of the things you have to do switching from a PC to a Mac or iPads and things is get away from those rules of how you thought things you have to do, drop down a menu, do that, versus a natural gesture with your hand, touch something, those kind of things, where kids pick that up quickly. They can pick up an iPad or a device and just take off, where we were kind of conditioned, these are the structures, and that's what you're talking about, more intuitive design of how we naturally move, how we naturally use products, et cetera, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And that really can extend, you know, within the product space or even within services, of trying to shake things up and change, you know, how services are delivered. What can you do to, you know, map out the entire journey that you have as, you know, a service or a product is delivered, so that you're looking for those, like as we said, white spaces,
right,
where you can shake things up in the market and deliver exceptional value to the customer base.
So when we look at what I would consider service-oriented companies, Amazon found white space.
Mm-hmm.
Google found white space.
Exactly.
In places where we didn't even know we were looking for that.
Right.
So like Amazon testing delivery with drones, that's white space. We're still not sure whether we're going to like that or not. But it's those kind of things, thinking outside of the box, looking at people wanting things more immediately, things easier to use, those kind of things, that we're out there trying to figure out where we're going to go.
Exactly. And even with the Amazon drone, it's a great example of, you know, there's probably going to be some individuals out there that are going to be early adopters of this that are eager to have the next great thing. You know, the people that bought the first iPad when it
right.
came out, when everybody was saying that was just an absurd idea. Now they're everywhere. Even with, say, the drones, you're going to have those people that are really excited to have that come to their door. But there's also going to be...
There's going to be the guy meeting it with a shotgun.
The late majority and laggards that right. there's absolutely no way they want drones flying over their house.
Right.
And there's a natural resistance to any new idea that has any significance. So the real question, if it's going to survive, is whether or not people are willing to accept it on the whole, or is it going to go the way of the Segway or, you know, other...
What was that?
brilliant ideas that just were before their time.
Right. The Etzel.
Yeah.
That looks like a VW. So it is. It's just when we think of that, and Etzel's probably a good transition. That wasn't a bad car. It just wasn't visually appealing, and the name probably was an issue too. I worked at Ford, so I love to pick on the Etzel.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're out there and you're looking at it, it's more than just the function. It's how it looks. Is it visually appealing? Coloration, name, branding, all of those kind of things.
Exactly. And those aren't arbitrary either. The people have a distinct psychological reaction to it's emotional in nature,
right.
that goes beyond just the features and benefits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the emotional, I guess, job that you're delivering of making somebody, like, for example, with cars, you know, a premium car delivers a premium experience and becomes a part of somebody's self-identity. And that's expressed through product development, product design, and making it really sleek and cool, and all that energy
right.
that goes into that, you know, serves a purpose for the consumer.
Well, and we identify with our products, and our products kind of let people know who we are. I was voted probably most likely to drive a Beamer or a Mercedes, but I'm a Subaru person, and I drive a Honda now. So it's those kind of things, because what someone else sees may not be what's influencing you and what makes your decisions in making a car purchase or anything else.
Yeah.
So when you're following people around trying to do that voice of the customer and not getting married to your shoes, what is that process? Your customer comes to you and says, okay, we want to have new patio furniture lines or something. How do you go from that perspective, or a new service? How do you help a company take that inkling of where they think a problem is, really define that problem, and focus them in, and then start creating those ideas?
That it's a prescriptive process. Okay. So what works in one situation, say, you know, mass consumer products, doesn't necessarily work in medical devices. And the rigors involved with each of those are very different. You know, in consumer products, you're really playing a pricing game.
Okay.
And in fact, the channel buyers,
the distribution channels.
Exactly. Okay. So whoever is responsible for a given category within a mass retailer has actually more influence over what goes on the shelves than the consumers do.
And so, they better be right.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's a lot of turnover as well for those who don't get it right.
Well, and we kind of see that because what we also see is companies that a JCPenney's that hires an Apple exec that doesn't meet their customer base, or a Coldwater Creek that filed bankruptcy and all this stuff. You saw when they were highly successful who was buying, what kind of products were there, and you saw this disconnect. Being a baby boomer, I don't buy really short skirts. I don't think I should be. But there for a while, the things that you saw on a Coldwater Creek didn't match up to who was really shopping there.
Right.
Right? And so that importance of the business, understanding their business and their customers, what you're getting at then, right? Because those channel buyers, those people making the decisions, have to be connected to the marketplace, so who's going to buy.
They do. And I was really speaking more from a vendor's perspective of that they can come in with their own customer research, but ultimately it depends on what the decision makers think about the research. But, yeah, no, there's some retailers you talk to where they know their products down to, if I sell it at – you know, 3 cents cheaper, then I know I'm going to have this huge lift in volume as a result of it. And so that mass retail, pricing strategy, if assuming the product works,
right.
And we're not necessarily talking about like a premium car here. You know, we're really talking about, like baby formula, something that's more of a commodity driven product. And that's something where, having that right mix of features and benefits and using brand to try to differentiate yourself from, say, the proprietary brands, is an important strategy and it's a consideration in that place. So your original question was, what do you do in
right.
that case? Usually in that case, you're trying to develop a product within a fairly limited budget that's going to hit the target and then move on. So usually we do trend research, go out and do some observation of what the context is, what are people buying. And then we'll also look at, in some cases for outdoor living, then we'd look upmarket. So there's Maison show over in France where you look at what are the hot furniture items that are happening right now. And then you try to, I hate to use the term, but you dumb it down for the mass market.
Right.
So that, it's not like an extremely
You make it
expensive.
Accessible.
Exactly.
You take it from being a $100,000 patio set to a $1,000 patio set that someone here can afford.
Exactly. But also fit in the context
right.
that people are going to be referencing. I mean, the American architecture is very different from European, and it has to fit within people's decorating tastes.
Well, and sizing.
Exactly.
So we can talk about airplane seats. They get narrower and narrower, and everybody else is getting broader and broader.
Right.
So it's making sure that when you're designing, it has function, it has form, it has an appearance, it has all those things that's going to make us want to buy it.
Exactly. And there's various points at which you check in with the consumer.
Okay.
I read a research paper that talked about the highest correlation of success for product development comes when you have talked to the customer at least 3 times.
Okay.
So at the initiation of a project, once you have kind of a core idea and you're trying to validate it, and then ultimately kind of pre-commercialization, coming back in and modifying your marketing and positioning and making sure it's going to appeal to people as best as possible.
Well, and that makes sense because it's like automotive. There's how many different cars out there and stuff, but the Mustang and its history is it's always been connected to its customer.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always had input since the initial success over the years. Any redesign, they're talking to the people who love the car and are going to buy it. And that's what you're saying. Successful products are connected to the people who are going to love it and buy it.
Right. And in that regard, too, like the Mustang hasn't changed a lot. They do incremental changes to it as they update the product line. And I think a similar case could be made for JCPenney, we mentioned earlier, in that, these radical shifts in your strategy lose your customers. And so that may have been the right call, but execution, you should have used multiple steps to get there along the way and test and refine, iterate, using some of the design thinking principles.
That's what one of the companies I worked with, I guess it's been about 12 years ago, decided they wanted to go to all this new technology, and they left the old technology sitting there and the customers they had. But the marketplace was not ready for the new technology. The houses weren't wired, all those kind of things. It's like, no, you tend the old business. You tend those customers. You keep going until this adoption process takes. That technology is everywhere now, but back then they went out of business because they made that switch.
Exactly.
It's expecting the marketplace to move too quickly to be all early adopters and everybody want to get on board.
Exactly. And that's an interesting point about the balance between kind of your operations of your existing product line and your innovation R&D effort for what's kind of coming next. There's usually a healthy tension that exists in the organization between your innovation group and your operations. I've heard that I've seen that the operations usually will consume the innovation budget if there isn't direct executive sponsorship and leadership of it. So that can kind of go two different directions of the case study where innovation ate the operations budget.
Well, and that's the tension within most companies is you're entrepreneurial, but you get to such a stage you have to corporate, you have to put some structures and some controls in, and then you have to find that balance because 3M, right? The innovation initiatives, they're always good at pirating budget out of other things. The Post-it note was never a funded project. Those kind of things. And so those innovative tensions that are there, you have to have some structures and some processes. Mm-hmm. But you also have to have an environment and a culture that encourages people to look for that white space, the answers, doing something differently.
Exactly.
And successful companies, Apple's been successful at it. I think they're struggling now that Steve Jobs is gone. But how much innovation and how much protecting your territory of what we've already done and we love this success can a company accommodate? So
right.
Who's going to win and how are you going to manage those processes?
Right. I think there's kind of a fraction of your time getting devoted, of everybody's time getting devoted to your own project. I think that's a very valuable concept. And so the idea, and we've implemented this internally, is that we've been calling it Overhead Friday Afternoons, where we're not allowed to work on billable hour projects, but we're really only working on something that either we're excited about and each individual within the team can, you know, has available, you know, time to, you know, bring something to fruition.
Right.
So we've recently just relaunched our website in a mobile-friendly platform, and a lot of that was due to, you know, having a dedicated effort of our Overhead Friday Afternoons to try to bring that about. And so anyway, we've had a lot of fun bringing that together and updating it, making sure it's with the latest in technology.
Right. So we talk to our customers. We're checking in 3 times during the design process. We're getting a feel for what's going to work. How do we move from drawings to an initial prototype to something we want to manufacture to getting it on the shelf, all of those kind of things?
Sure. So with an initial concept sketch, you know, at this point in time, it's your lowest resolution way of getting an idea expressed.
Okay.
So then you move from the concept sketch to more of a dimension drawing, where you're starting to define this and say, all right, it needs to be 33 millimeters and a diameter of 4.5, and really saying this is roughly the shape we're talking about.
So you're moving from a pencil sketch to a CAD drawing.
Well, kind of initial dimensional drawing, and then we move into 3D CAD.
Okay.
So we use SolidWorks, which is a very commonly used 3D CAD software modeling tool. It's primarily the domain of a lot of mechanical engineers.
Right.
But we've really tried to make sure that our industrial design deliverables are really set up in that software so that we move directly from an appearance model that, you know, has the design intent of the sketch. And that's usually a big loss that happens as you move from a sketch, which looks cool and is expressive, to something that's actually going to exist in reality. So we, you know, it's kind of like using a screwdriver as a hammer sometimes because getting that beautiful arc and everything really isn't always easily achieved. But the beauty of that is once we're done with that, and we've gotten where we hit that goal, then we just hit print.
Okay.
And there's any number of rapid prototyping shops that are out there where we can look at different materials. Some of them are biocompatible.
Right.
Where you could, you know, already have liquids stored in it. It'd be safer, you know, humans to interact with. To, you know, being able to print metal pieces.
Cool, I was going to say the 3D printing and stuff probably gives you a lot more capability to do things. Did this work? Here's the drawing. Print it. What's the problems? Those kind of things.
Exactly. And our cycle time gets a lot faster as a result. You know, you can even get to where you have overnight prints done. which is really cool from just trying to get speed to market, then we can get to a point where, like, all right, we roughly know what we're talking about here. And there's a big switch that happens from developing something on the computer to seeing it in reality and understanding.
And production representative, because then taking it from even the prototype, automotive was the best experience I had, taking it from that prototype that we made 5 or 10 by hand with the equipment, then to mass production on the actual equipment to do a run, and then finding out what are those issues, switching it on and off the assembly lines, different posts, tooling designs, those kind of things.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's usually something that you learn when you've built it that you didn't originally see. And so that's something that we've come to expect, which is why we call them prototypes. And you usually have to go through several iterations of those prototypes before you arrive at something that is ready to be mass produced.
So what's the equivalent in service that you take that design process through? You know what the solution is, and you want to design a service or like your website or something like that that's less tangible. What's the parallel to that?
You know, we facilitate ideation sessions.
Okay.
Where it's a structured creative process. And part of that structure comes in of people who aren't ordinarily comfortable with the creative process, having structure so that it's a safe space where you can get introduced to the idea of creativity. We bring Nerf guns and Play-Doh and really try to get people out and usually try to be offsite from a client organization and make it so that people are comfortable with the setup. We found that with service design that we use a methodology called Act It Out.
Okay.
Where we start off with mapping out each of the steps along the customer journey, particularly with a service design. Mm-hmm. And then we actually used this recently where we had the client envision an evil version of themselves.
I've run into some of those.
But have them say, all right, well, what would the evil version of you do? Right. Exactly the same, but take customer service and make it the worst possible experience for your customer and act that out. And then we brainstorm solutions around, you know, what would be the ideal version of this. And so it was an easy switch to be kind of a little bit self-critical and mocking, but having it be this comfortable foil that people could assign there. And it also identifies where you would need to go forward pretty easily.
So in that process, it's probably, I'm going to say, the biggest obstacle I would expect with getting people to let down those barriers and those defense mechanisms of not wanting. So one of the old exercises 20 years ago when they wanted you to get creative, they would ask you for toppings for a pizza. And they expected you to come up with things like prunes, you know, and that kind of stuff. Because they would give you these weird target markets. So what would you put on an 80-year-old pizza or whatever? And so it's laying down those barriers and being willing to do that in front of your team, right? And so isn't that a kind of a trust issue? How successful companies are at doing this is how strong their teams are and willingness to share and things like that?
Yeah, it's very much a team-building activity. And there's one thing that I've found is helpful in that environment is identifying people's creative profile.
Okay.
And it's kind of like, you know, your Myers-Briggs profiles, but it's an approach to creativity. Some people are generators, and they're kind of rare in large organizations. But basically, they're constantly coming up with new ideas and constantly presenting, okay, well, here's another idea I've got. Well,
they're rare because they get shot down and kicked out.
Exactly, and usually find their way over to more of an entrepreneurial venture.
Right.
And then you have more of the conceptualizers, which can take those ideas and then start to kind of wrap, okay, well, this is what this could be and build upon it.
Mm-hmm.
Optimizers then say, all right, well, if we're going to move this into production, then here's everything we need to do. And then you also have implementers, which are people that are actually going to be boots on the ground and making it happen. And you need that mix of all four in order to have a really effective ideation session.
Right. I kind of have a different parallel. I call it explorers, mountain men, pioneers, and settlers.
Okay.
Because that is different personas. A settler will never be an explorer.
Right.
But you need the settler to make things go forward and stay, keep working on an ongoing basis. So how do you sit down with them? Do you give them a paper test? How do you determine what everyone is when you're getting ready to work on it?
There's a service out there that will take you through the testing process and help you identify kind of what your creative profile is. I've gotten to where I can just about spot people. So if we're doing it informally and probably for a lower budget, then we can kind of say, all right, well, this is going to be our team composition for this one ideation session. And usually if it looks like it's a group of implementers, and I try to pull in a generator from our team and make sure they're present in the room just so that the energy keeps moving we don't stay too close to what's been done right now.
Well, it's like in running companies. There are people who are innovative, they're leaders, they create the idea, but they can't run the business on a day-to-day basis. And it's a similar thing that you're talking about, is mm-hmm. that different personality types that every organization needs
right.
to, in order to grow.
Yeah.
So we go through, we do these great idea sessions for our services, we figure out processes, we get a prototype. What do we need to think about besides that when we're getting ready to start a brand image, naming, all those kind of things? And we'll do it after the break. We're talking with Ty Hagler of Trig Innovation, and we will be right back after this. Well, we're back, and Ty said, he's correcting me, he was not an Olympian, he was only a world champion. Twice, I believe is what you said.
Yeah, I attended the world championships okay. twice.
I'm trying to get him even more stellar stuff, so tell us about that, and
okay.
we'll get into the rest of it.
Well, so and we talked a little bit about some of my background, but I had gotten into kayaking as a result of the 1996 Olympics when
okay.
they came to Atlanta, and we were living in Gainesville, Georgia. And so I was 16 years old at the time, and we were volunteers holding the Olympic kayakers as they
okay.
were starting each of their races. And along the way, we got access to Olympic coaches and really got
Ooh.
Caught the fever to really start going after the sport. And so did this for a number of years, did it all the way through college. And then 2003, when I graduated college, was also qualified for the 2003 World Championships.
Okay.
And also got married to my lovely wife, Gail.
Ah.
It was a pretty eventful year. The results of that World Championships earned me a spot on the Home Depot's Olympic Job Opportunities Program.
Okay.
Where you get paid full-time and you work part-time in the stores, and the rest
Ooh.
Of your time
training
you're
so you're working full-time, you're just not in the store working or working at the corporate.
Exactly. You're right. It was something I'm incredibly thankful for. It gave me the opportunity to continue the dream for a number of
does
years.
Does Home Depot still do that program?
No, unfortunately they
oh.
stopped doing the program as part of the downturn. They really had to get it was one of the things that they had considered, and
right.
Ultimately, but there's a number of other companies that do support that and have tried to return that as well, and bring on interns that are athletes and give them some support that, you know, it goes beyond a sponsorship
right.
and really trying to give them work experience.
Well, and that's something, giving back one, but that transition from being a student, we were talking about it before we started the show. That transition from being a student and realizing what the real world is about and being able to think and make decisions and understand, I picked this career, what does it really look like?
Right.
Right, and you try it on before you buy it.
Exactly.
So you're not married to it before you spend all that tuition money.
Yeah, and one of the challenges of being a full-time athlete is that you're not gaining work experience. And so you may be 5 years out of school and trying to transition to the career, and you're coming in at the same level as somebody who recently graduated from their college degree. And so that's, creates some real challenges. And that was what was really special about that program for me was, it gave me some, work experience that was directly in line with what I wanted to do, which is kind of an interesting story there. We kind of led off with that a
right.
bit. I was supposed to work in the stores, at the Home Depot
Retail.
Offices. Yeah.
Okay.
And the Home Depot corporate offices were right there. So I wound up landing in the advertising department, building print pages for a while. And then I kept mentioning that, hey, this product development thing I did was kind of interesting. So I had my first manager's, Brian Habeck, he saw a lot of potential in that.
Mm-hmm.
Said, all right, well, why don't you see if you can go after this one idea that our VP of advertising pitched at a creative meeting. Wound up going through developing that into a series of concept sketches where there was a kind of a new way
right.
to shook up that product category. And that the VP of advertising loved it so much, he wound up pitching it to some of the other
right.
executives. And it really became this kind of catalyzing moment that said, we should do this in-house. And so I wound up going through and being a part of making that case to a lot of the rest of the executives and uncovering where those opportunities for innovation might be within the product line. Ultimately, I wound up coming down to managing the proprietary brands within Home Depot.
Right.
And so I wound up doing a lot of the internal innovation processes for product development, tons of projects going on at any given point in time. We were following a Let 1,000 Flowers Bloom strategy where we were trying to deliver innovation to
right.
every category there. And it was just a lot of fun during that process.
Well, and you have an interesting personality, because I'm just going to say, you're a generator, obviously. You're innovative, but you also execute, which is rare. You don't see it in businesses around that you can do both, that you can come up with the ideas, you can take process, you can lead the team. Because generally, we tend to have people that are introverted and lab-type people,
mm-hmm.
or bean counters, accountants. We have different personalities, and so, I have the creative background as an artist and a writer, but I'm also the one that says this has to get done and this process has to work this way and hopefully you guys are not hearing the drill going behind us, and I apologize if that's causing too much background noise. They're apparently going to drill to China from here.
Yeah.
But you're back there in corporate world, and Ford, you know, they would say, well, we want to innovate this. Well, I would take them at their word. They'd put out something. Well, how would we change this process? And I'd write a white paper. And I'd get called to world headquarters saying, why did you do this? As you asked, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, dynamite kid, because I wanted to blow it up, put something new in. And they're like, well, we were going to tweak it. I was like, you don't tweak something that's broken. You put in something that works.
Exactly.
Right? And that's essentially what you're talking about in product. If we want to disrupt the marketplace, we want to see why there's that white space, what can we put in that? That's what we're doing.
Exactly, right.
And if we can do it with a brand, we get more value for it, we get a name, we get recognition, and it has a bigger impact.
Exactly. And really, the proprietary brands within a store, and that, you know, a good case in point. So the reason why, you know, retail stores have proprietary brands is that let's say you go in to buy a hammer, you don't want to go in to buy the Home Depot hammer. The brand around the retail experience and the brand around the product are two very different, entities.
Yeah, because in the mind, the store brand, a grocery store, mm-hmm. the store brand is not viewed as high-end as the name brand.
Exactly, right.
But that may actually be the best stage of the crop they got was the second crop rather than the first crop.
Right.
And that's the difference. So you might have better taste and quality.
Right.
But it's a perception.
Yeah, and I think the grocery store brands probably made I would say from a branding perspective, mm-hmm. I would not have chosen that to have a Kroger brand item, because you want to have that be distinct. You don't want to have an opening price point product offering, you know, expressing your overall retail strategy. Mm-hmm. I think those are two distinct things that you need to keep separate in the minds of the consumers.
Well, and it's interesting because, again, branding, we see Kroger, and I'll pick on Kroger, mm-hmm. they are introducing that Simple Truth brand. It's still a store brand, mm-hmm. but it's got a subtle difference of more organic, more natural, mm-hmm. those kind of things. But still, it's a Kroger proprietary brand.
Right.
And so that gives you a different mindset than if it's a Lars Beef, you're buying Simple Truth.
Exactly.
And so you have to convince someone that it really is equally good.
Yeah, and so you're having to go through that same brand building process that any, I guess, individual manufacturer or vendor would have to go through, except that you just have the channel authority to be able to push your product and position it competitively, because it's in your favor to, as a retailer, it's in your favor to have your proprietary brands be as strong as the national brands.
Right. So what is a brand? How do we decide can we just decide, okay, I want a brand, and pick a name, all those kind of things. Walk us through that. How does a brand develop, and how do we do that?
Sure. So first we have to understand what a brand is. So a brand ultimately is an empty file folder.
Love that. Okay. I have an empty file folder.
Right. So this is the file folder that every experience you have with this company gets in somebody's mental file folder, gets logged into that system.
Okay.
So the what you do with all of those experiences either adds brand equity or takes away. So, and from a financial standpoint, that's defined as goodwill.
Right.
Which is really hard to quantify. Some people spend a lot of time doing that. But I think as you go through in each of your experiences, and the brand identity and the name really come down to being able to have a clear enough file folder,
right,
so that you can attach meaning to it.
Well, and brands evolve. So we would have said BlackBerry before, and we would have thought innovative. We say BlackBerry now, and we think dying product.
Exactly.
And so we have to be aware of that brand life, mm-hmm. and what we do to keep it innovative, relevant, and meaningful.
Right. And the problem with the BlackBerry brand is that the BlackBerry so actually it's RIM.
Right.
And so the BlackBerry brand itself is attached to a product.
Mm-hmm.
But RIM itself, Research in Motion, might still be able to introduce a new brand,
right.
Of products that might have new life for it and be able to, you know, enter back into
the market.
It
doesn't mean the business will die, but a brand can die.
Absolutely.
And a brand can kill a business if that's the only thing they can do.
Exactly.
Right. So we're going to create a brand. We have this empty file folder. So it's every touch, look, thought, customer service interaction. It's what color it is, how I react to the name. Like green used to be a bad thing for products. Now green means environmental.
Right.
So again, it's culture, timing, those kind of things.
Exactly. So there's, yeah, there's product attributes and non-product attributes that go into, you know, encompassing a brand. And so good brand management makes sure that you don't change things too fast. You don't, if you're going to change the name, change the logo, you do it very intentionally and you try to do it all at once. You don't introduce confusion out there and make it so that people have a fuzzy file folder.
Right.
You know, that they don't really have a clear bucket to drop all these associations.
So we don't know if it still is the same company we did business. It's not the same product. So JCPenney.
Right.
It had a brand, it had an image, it had a customer base. And now they're going to become innovative, cutting-edge, short skirts versus maxi skirts, whatever you want to call it. And that was a dissonance with their customer base.
Exactly. And that might have been a bridge too far that what they might have done.
Or a bridge to nowhere.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm going to pick on JCPenney's.
But I think what they might have done if they wanted to do that is to have a separate brand experience. Where a kind of similar example might be Home Depot Expo stores, if you remember
okay.
those.
Vaguely.
They were discontinued. I used to work for some Expo right. sports portions. But the Expo stores was kind of the ultra-premium home improvement product experience. And so you'd go there and you'd get the latest and greatest tile or the most expensive
right.
furniture or whatever you'd want. But they made that a separate store experience.
High-end versus the big box.
It's a different customer.
Right. Okay.
And it needs to be an experience that serves a different customer. So I think ultimately that they could have done something that, you know, they could have left JCPenney and they could have had, you know, Penny's Premium or something like that, that, you know, was a,
right.
a separate experiment that if it died, then it wouldn't hurt operations.
Well, and when we think of brands, M&M's, you know, we think of BMWs. I mean, we can look across anything, Apple. Those are things that when we say those names, people know who and what they are.
Exactly.
Coke is Coke everywhere.
Right.
And so tissues, you know, Kleenex. We asked for a Kleenex, right? Because the brand became so dominant that everybody associated every tissue with Kleenex, whether it was or not. Google.
Right.
We Google something, even when we're on Internet Explorer searching. So it's those kind of things that make that transition, that our experience, the features, the benefits, all of that is so predominant that it dominates the marketplace
exactly.
in that category.
And in a great case in point, I mean, Coke is has the most value of any brand of out there. I think there's religious symbols that are at equivalent levels
right.
to Coke. Just it's that pervasive across the. I guess everybody has that file folder in their minds. And so as soon as you say that, I mean, the Open Happiness campaign pops into your mind, all of the images of
right.
Santa Claus and
polar bears.
Yeah.
Well, and with Coke, there's a comedian that does the little thing. Him and his wife goes to a restaurant, and he goes, "You want something to drink?" She goes, "Yeah, I'll have a Coke." "Well, what kind of Coke?" "Well, you don't want a root beer? You want an orange?" He's like, "Well, I'll have a Coke." You know, and you go through that thing because Coke doesn't always mean Coke. It's a product category, but it has so become part of our vocabulary
mm-hmm.
that a soda pop, a beverage, a carbonated drink is a Coke.
Right.
And then everything else goes from that.
Right.
Poor
right,
Pepsi.
Exactly. Yeah.
Dr. Pepper fan here.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think of that, we think of a brand, and let's look at some of the others that are out there, and we see things that happen in the media. Chick-fil-A. It has a brand. It has a position.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's not open on Sunday. We know what its corporate values are. We know it's food, those kind of things. That is that file folder full of very precise experiences and market information and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that was, I mean, it was clearly very deliberate. I mean, they had to stand on very strong principles in order to maintain not being open on Sunday. There's early stories of the founding there where, that there was, they needed to get into a certain mall food court and they stood firm on not being
right.
able to go in there. And ultimately, the mall owners caved into that. That principle. I think that's something that I've heard creates latent demand
right.
by not being open on Sundays, that there's more demand for
well,
it.
Well, if you're going to think, I'm going to go to Chick-fil-A this weekend, then you're either going to buy it Saturday night, or you're going to go on Saturday, because you're going to, it's not open on Sunday.
Right.
You accommodate that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they have uncommon service. They look out and they say, all right, well, what would our competitors not do? And we're going to do that.
Right.
And so, different things bringing the food to you and just that uncommon level of service, has really set it apart. And it makes it really easy if you've got, two kids and you're trying to keep them happy and well-fed, then that's an easy decision to go and take them there.
Well, and it's, when we think, too, we're kind of U.S.-centric, but if we think about this from a brand, from a world market, how do companies make the decision? So automotive, I love to pick on automotive. When Ford tried to have a world car single name, mm-hmm. it was going to be the same name everywhere, and they thought they were good until they found out in some dialect in South America it meant something you shouldn't say. So the car became like two or three different names. Uh-huh. So how do we consciously make a decision that we want a product that's going to be worldwide, international? I'm not going to say universal because we're not selling it on Mars. But how do you make it that it's appealing and a brand can jump, like Coke, those kind of things? What kind of considerations do we have to think through?
I actually wrote a paper on that in school.
Cool. You didn't tell me that.
Yeah. So there's a balance between global and local. And that's not just brand, but it extends all the way down to, you know, tactical, you know, local advertising you're doing in Italy. And I think there's a balance to strike, and Coke in particular is famous for having switched between these different balances where you try to have centralized control,
okay.
where you're pushing out the exact same message globally. And the problem is that what may resonate with your country of origin isn't necessarily going to resonate in, you know, the absolute farthest corner of the globe.
Right.
And so it really comes back to, you know, and also, too, if you have everything too locally controlled, there was a problem where there was an Italian advertising firm that was having some risque images were associated with Coke, and that did not fit with the brand, and so they were having to tamp down on that. So there's a balance to strike between local control
right.
and central control, and I think that's ultimately the real challenge of managing.
Well, and if
brand.
I think of Chick-fil-A, I think it's Carl Jr.'s that has the weird commercial with the babes in bikinis and stuff eating the burgers and stuff like that. I would never expect to see that from a Chick-fil-A, and that would be inconsistent.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're sitting out there looking, and I have to flash back. You said you wrote a paper in school. I shouldn't confess this, but it was probably 30-some years ago. For my international marketing class, I was assigned to market sweet corn in France. Sweet corn in France didn't really exist. It was pig food. That's what corn was for over there. And so here's this, again, U.S.-centric product or South American, Mexico. We used a lot of corn, maize, that kind of stuff. But France, that was not a normal food to be on the table. And so
it's not grown locally, right?
Yeah. So it's like they're like, okay, I'm like, do they even know what corn is? And you start looking at statistics. A lot of corn is bought, but it turned out it was all farm food.
Mm-hmm.
And so how would you overcome that difference when you're going to take tortillas or other products to Europe that they weren't used to? And so that, again, you have to get out of that, well, everybody uses it here mindset to, well, what's their message and what's their background there and how long would it take to introduce something?
Right. And I think if you were to try to do that, you'd really want to go back to the good design thinking principles and spend a lot of time going out and seeing people's attitudes towards food, whether or not corn would be something to be introduced. Is there a way that you could brand it that, you know, speaks to some regional areas that, you know, like would more naturally use it so that people would more closely identify with it? But ultimately, that comes back to really understanding your customer. And in a lot of cases, I'd probably use a local design group that understands that base and probably has grown up there and can intuit kind of what that message that might resonate for a given product.
So we're out there, and I'd say we have a product here. It's been doing great in the States, and we want to take it to Asia. How do we think about packaging and color? And I've used this example in another show. One of my clients contracted for an earth tone website to Asia. Well, it came in blue and green. So earth tone did not mean they were looking at it. If I look at the earth from outer space, it's blue and green. And so, so those kind of those kind
minute there,
okay,
yeah.
Sorry, but it kind of takes you. Earth tone to us means browns and sand tones and, you know, adobe colors. This kind of, you know, the Grand Canyon type thing. Where over there to them it didn't translate the same way.
Sure.
Do we have to think that detail as to colors and names and lettering styles and all of those kind of things?
Oh, sure, absolutely. And you have some. And I don't try to design for, I guess, other countries,
right.
Because I think it's like having that, you need to have that local understanding of what the contexts are. A great example from architecture in Hong Kong, there's the IM Pei building,
right?
That has the X's going all the way up the building, and there's a cultural resistance to X. I mean, it's a symbol for death in China, and so people would not want to go towards the building because of that, you know, use of such a strong symbol that we wouldn't have picked up
right.
on. Like, oh, cool, that's an interesting X design. Seems kind of edgy.
Looks like a one-sided tic-tac-toe board.
Exactly, yeah.
But yeah, the different images, different cultural, mm-hmm. different colors. Red
right.
for celebration, white for mourning.
Right.
And there's just such a dynamic that challenges when you're out there. And then when I have to write and want something for translation, financially I would write bottom line, and everyone know here in the States what bottom line means. That's not what gets translated overseas.
Yeah.
So you have to think, well, profit or loss. You have to think of how you term things, how you position things, how you message. So is it always a best interest to take it to the local market to work with someone? Or
I would argue so. I mean, I think you see like some of the larger design consultancies that are out there that have local offices.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they're going to be producing for China, then they have an office in Shanghai. And, you know, they might have, you know, global directors coming in to manage the process, but ultimately they're hiring local designers. And similarly, I've seen some really funny presentations from Chinese design firms that, you know, tried to show us what American tastes were. They referenced a movie that was popular at the time and did all of their
right.
beautiful work, but there's no way it was going to resonate here because they were just getting the cultural references
the nuance. Yeah,
yeah,
the nuance.
And I think we'd do the same thing if we tried to do, you know, appeal to a local market
well,
elsewhere.
It's even facial expressions. I know working with some people overseas, we can smile as Americans because we're thinking sarcastically or whatever, and they think, well, everything's fine if you're smiling, and it's like, you know, it can be sarcasm. So, again, it's a cultural communications, those subtle things we want to do out there.
Right.
If I'm out there and I'm trying to think packaging, is it as important to design the package appearances as the product I'm putting inside that packaging?
It depends on whether or not you're in mass retail or if you're doing dropship.
Okay.
So if you're doing you know, something where it's Amazon.com and or direct from TV, then
right.
and you're dropshipping it, then you just want a big dumb box.
Okay.
You know, have a really nice user manual in it, but have it so that it's going to protect the product and get it
What's a user manual? Someone asked me for one the other day on a computer, and I'm like, it's on the computer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what I want, the user manual on the computer. I was like, no, it only comes on the computer. You have to go to the website.
Mm-hmm.
So user manuals. Okay.
Right. But if it's something where it's going to be sitting on a shelf, then, you know, ultimately that is your billboard.
Okay.
And you have 5 seconds to get somebody's attention as they're walking by for them to pick up the product and be able to try to learn more about your product. And so that there's a real art to doing good packaging design and having your brand stand out, having a positioning statement that resonates with people so that your product flies off the shelf instead of gathers dust.
Colors, does that make an impact? Does that make a difference? And do we want it blue and green or brown and tan or those kind of things when we're making those packaging decisions?
Well, you certainly don't want to have every single color thrown at something. And
kaleidoscope.
Right, right. And I think, too, there's certain industries where I think color and design and aesthetics don't make a big impact.
Okay.
Particularly if human beings aren't going to be touching it. If you're in a robotics
right.
industry, probably not going to, it's not going to be, you know, industrial automation, probably not going to see as much, you know, design and color impact. But if you're doing something that's a consumer product, where emotions are a major part of the purchase decision, where somebody might do an impulse buy, you know, throw it in the cart, then color and brand speak a lot and evoke a lot of different emotions. And you really need to be very careful with how you do it. I took a color class where in undergrad that the teacher gave this example of why color is important, is that there was one restaurant that did a lot of research into, you know, what type of color would make everybody hungry.
And orange, so, and red and yellow.
Exactly. And you see those themes propagate. And so they spent a lot of time researching that and studying it and getting it nailed down. And there was a competitor that came along and tried to copy the color, but they didn't do it quite right. And they had a much higher return rate of food because people's stomachs were just like, this food doesn't taste good. And the psychology of the color was making them feel like there's something wrong with the food.
Right.
So,
well, and I mean, it's, you see it in the restaurants, but it's also, it's a dynamic, it's a high energy,
mm-hmm.
It's a power collar, and it also makes people leave faster.
Exactly.
So you're turning over your tables faster in a highly colorful orange and red environment.
Exactly. So we have a very active four-year-old, and we try to make sure his room is like blues or really soothing colors.
So is it working, Ty?
It helps.
It helps. So you didn't do primary collar?
No. Well, I mean, depends on the primary color. But yeah, like a warm color, no.
So, I mean, we're setting out there. And I know when I go in the bookstores, because the biggest thing we've been designing lately are book covers. Mm-hmm. And the most recent book, I just kind of turned it over because I had no idea what I wanted the cover to look like. Mm-hmm. And it's the ABCs of Biblical Change.
Okay.
And so when they called and sent me the initial one, they said, well, it's kind of a golden brown. I'm thinking, not colors I like, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not an earth tone person. And then we were doing the posters. I said, well, the only one that's going to really match is to have a brown edge. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, how am I going to react to that?
Yeah.
But then when you see it on the bookshelf with others, it stands out. It's not a brown, dull brown. It's kind of have a golden life to it.
Yeah.
And so it looks fine, which, you know, when you go on the bookshelf, you want it to be appealing visually to stand out and amongst all the black books, the white books. The book before this I did, it was orange, because mm-hmm. when I walked in the bookstore, there were no orange books. Now there's all kinds of orange books. But it's those kind of, how do you get it to jump off the shelf kind of decisions.
Exactly. And you can use color to differentiate. I mean, the animal kingdom has many, many examples of color being used to signal for a lot of different, I mean, you know, peacocks, you know, in particular, you know, use very bright colors.
It's usually the guys showing off.
Yeah, that's right.
Nature. So, yeah, I mean, you just have to think of that dynamic. But in the 60s, no food product would be in a green package because it was associated with mold.
Oh, okay.
Right, and so when you're in the 60s is before his time, not mine. And so as you came out in the 60s and 70s, and then the environmental movement and green transitioned to something else. So mm-hmm. it's interesting to see in a space of 30, 40, 50 years how color perceptions have changed.
Yeah, well, and even the green brand itself, you talk about environmental right. packaging. That's something where you have the problem of greenwash, where companies can claim, you know, an environmentally friendly product.
Right.
But ultimately, it may not be environmentally friendly. And so then you have to have certain standards, you know, associated with that. So then it's not just anymore a company making a claim, but, you know, going through some regulatory process of validating that.
Like certified organic. And
exactly.
All
right. And
well, we're at the end of the hour. I want you to leave our guests with couple things. One great design tip that everybody should think of before they start a new product.
Ooh, okay.
Check the white space.
You know, I mean, I've told this as I've talked to inventors, is that I'm not interested in your idea. I'm interested in the problem you're solving. If you've identified a really good problem to solve, the idea can shift around, but it's that opportunity that's where you're going to make or break your, you know, this project that you're wanting to take on. So it comes back to, okay, I've got an idea, but what is it I'm really trying to solve? And get back, and I had a professor that said this, so he just, you know, sat down on this, you have to really, really, really understand the problem. He went on for like 15 reallys. But it kind of drove home the point that if you're not solving a problem for your customer,
they ain't buying.
Exactly. And I mean, unless you want to do a beautiful artwork that has all this cool technology but nobody buys it, then you're just doing an art installation.
I've seen a lot of those companies. Yeah. Then the other thing is, how do people get in touch with you? Give them your Twitter, your email, whatever you want to give them, your website, however you want them to get in touch with you.
Sure, absolutely. So the Twitter handle is at Ty Hagler. That's T-Y-H-A-G-L-E-R. And our website is Trig Innovation, T-R-I-G. Innovation, and we're
.com.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, and yeah, we can be reached and be happy to talk to people about the product ideas or branding and really help them to come to commercialization.
That's great. And Ty, thank you for being on the show today. And until next week, everyone, stay focused on the important things.